This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. What led up to the war in Iraq and what happened during the conflict have generated a long series of questions. Some go to the heart of intelligence and leadership. Others are more personal. Some may not be answered for years, if ever. Others are beginning to come a bit clearer. In this hour, we'll raise some of those questions. Later in the program, Dana Priest of the Washington Post joins us to talk about what we know and what we don't about the capture and rescue of Private Jessica Lynch. And in a few minutes, reporter Peter Moss will talk about life as an unembedded journalist in Iraq and what one unit of Marines had to do to fight its way into Baghdad. But first to the fighting that continues in Iraq. Over the past week and a half, U.S. forces have mounted two large operations. Last week, Peninsula Strike swept through the areas north and west of Baghdad. The so-called Sunni Triangle is the part of Iraq most loyal to Saddam Hussein and where many of the armed attacks on Americans have occurred. And this week, Operation Desert Scorpion is targeted against resistance in a broader swath of Iraq. Joining us now from Baghdad is NPR's Nick Spicer. And Nick, good of you to be with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, Neil.
It's now day three of Desert Scorpion. Many of the sweeps are being conducted in and around the city of Baghdad itself. Can you tell us what you're seeing and hearing about this operation?
Well, we're hearing from military officials that 69 raids were conducted in different places in Baghdad, inside the capital. 150 people were rounded up. There were also roundups in Tikrit, which is, of course, Saddam Hussein's hometown, and in Kirkuk in northern Iraq. Most of the people were released after the arrests. This is part of a new sort of carrot and stick approach on the part of the American military. After the troops move into villages or towns or in parts of Baghdad today, other troops arrive with humanitarian aid. They do work. They rebuild soccer fields. Today we understand that they helped deliver salaries to certain workers. They helped deliver gasoline, which is still in shortage across significant parts of the country. So the idea is to sort of win the hearts and minds of the people, because people have been reacting badly to these raids in the past.
Any idea of how this is working?
Well, if we go by, it's hard to know how it's working. We can go by the number of arrests. It's astonishing to note that the number of people who are released, the proportion is something like 1 to 10 in Operation Peninsula Strike last week. 400 people were rounded up and 30 were detained. So it doesn't seem to be especially, perhaps, targeted. It's received poorly by many people in the towns north and west of Baghdad, if we go by what we saw last week. Lots of people complaining about being manhandled, about their houses being ransacked, and about Muslim sensibilities being trampled, particularly as concerns the treatment of women. We understand, though, the army tells us that special efforts are being made to make sure that these sensibilities are respected, and so women MPs will frisk the women. But it appears to be a bit of a problem. It's not clear that there is a cause and effect relation between continuing attacks on U.S. troops and the raids, which are going on in the way that I've just been describing a somewhat aggressive manner. We can't say there's a cause and effect relation so far, but we don't know if the raids are creating members of this resistance, this unidentified guerrilla resistance, but it's not being well received by most people.
And the other question, of course, about it is that has it reduced the numbers of attacks on American troops?
Well, no, not at all. It's a great question. In fact, they're ongoing. There was, unfortunately, a Marine shot in the back by a sniper today in Baghdad, which is a place where you think normally the U.S. troops have sort of secured things. Most of the attacks on U.S. troops have been taking, as you were saying, north and west of the capital. This is one right in the city center. There was also an explosive device, which is believed to have been a mine that blew up in a tunnel inside the city today. So it doesn't really seem to be reducing the number of attacks. Of course, the goal of Peninsula Strike and the goal of Desert Scorpion is to, in part, find the people who are launching these attacks, who are identified differently. Perhaps the military planners think they may be members of the Fedayeen, popular fighters who supported Saddam Hussein. They could be Ba'ath Party officials. They could be what the American military planners call suspected terrorists. So it's really hard to know who they might be.
Now, one of the things that happened today, Paul Bremer, who's the head of the interim administration trying to bring things into order there in Iraq, told a news conference today it would now be illegal for Iraqis to incite violence. Does that mean incitement to violence? Does it mean the same thing when it's illegal here as it means there?
It's not really clear what the details of that decision will be. It is illegal, for instance, if you're thinking of engaging in political activity to incite violence. That's the one sort of party platform that will get you excluded from the new democracy that American and British planners are trying to set up here. I don't really know. It'll be interesting. I don't know what it is, to answer your question, how the measure will be applied. And of course, it will be interesting to see how it is applied. If it ends up being a limit on free speech, if it ends up being a limit on some forms of assembly, that may well generate other kinds of resentment.
We shall have to see how that is applied. One of the problems, of course, has been there is no functioning court system or police, for that matter, in Iraq. And Ambassador Bremer tried to address that today as well.
Yes, he did. He announced the creation of a special court which would deal in particular with suspected members, high-ranking members of the Ba'ath Party, which he dissolved as one of his first decrees here upon his arrival. It's important because the Ba'ath Party members still seem to be holding on to positions in some of the new services and ministries that the American administrators are setting up. We had problems with police chiefs turning out to actually be holding meetings of Ba'ath Party officials, former Ba'ath Party officials, to see what they could do to sort of undermine U.S. reconstruction efforts. And these were people who had been vetted by American officials. So the high-ranking Ba'ath Party officials holding on to positions of power, escaping the vetting process, continues to be a problem. I think this is a part of an intention on Bremer's part to show people that something is being done to put an end to the previous government, to the previous regime. I mean, people, Saddam Hussein is still at large. That is a problem. Lots of efforts are being put, for instance, in just digging up the bomb sites where there were assassination attempts on Saddam Hussein during the war. There's a sense that officials here would really like to show people that Saddam Hussein and everybody who was associated with him won't be coming back to haunt them, to influence their lives. And I think that the decision to set up a court, a special court to try high-ranking Ba'ath Party members, is part of that.
We're going to be spending some time this hour talking about press coverage of the war. Can you tell us what kind of access you're getting now, both to not only to the military, but to the civil administration there in Baghdad?
Well, the military events are, of course, hard to get to, and the military will always say there's operational secrecy, which is a perfectly valid argument. It's also dangerous, it's just not stuff that one can get to easily because it's often far out of Baghdad, and you'll hear about it, and you'll have to drive out, and this stuff is done at 3 in the morning, and afterwards, there's not much left to see. However, you can question villagers and find out what has happened, and then compare notes. It was really interesting, though, to note that at the launch of Desert Scorpion on Sunday, U.S. military spokesmen were saying there are things going on across the country. There are nationwide raids. And we quickly found out that there were things going on in Fallujah with a heavy American troop presence and raids, but nothing else. And there was a bit of a disconnect between the announcement made and what was actually happening. And it turns out that there really wasn't much until things stepped up today. As far as getting access to the civilian authority here, it's really hard to get in touch with officials and to find out what is being decided. Frequently, they will ask not to have their names used, not to be quoted directly. So we're finding out what's being decided in the name of the Iraqi people, but kind of on a no-name basis. And it's frustrating for reporters, but of course, the situation must be much worse for the Iraqi people, who don't know to whom they should address their complaints if things are going wrong, and many people believe that there are lots of things that need to be addressed and that are still going wrong: security, electricity, no jobs, and the money situation.
Well, NPR's Nick Spicer, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Nick Spicer spoke with us from Baghdad. If you'd like to join our conversation about Iraq, you can give us a phone call, by the way. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Joining us now is Peter Moss, a journalist who recently wrote an article in the July issue of Outside magazine called The Race to Baghdad, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here.
One of the things you wrote in the article is that all wars are unpredictable in unpredictable ways. In what way was this war unpredictable?
This war was unpredictable in that there were so many different dangers that were hard to prepare for and hard to know when they would occur. You know, dangers not just of being shot by, let's say, Iraqi troops or captured by them, also dangers of being shot by the very troops that you were with, American troops, because the moment you got out of their sight line, you became potentially hostile. And there were also mines, and there were also chemical attacks, and there was also, just for the unembedded journalists driving their own vehicles, we had to drive at night with these Marines without night vision goggles, and that was a quite new danger that none of us had experienced.
Well, as you mentioned, you were unembedded. In other words, you were not selected to be a part of one of, to stay with one unit. You were driving around on your own. I guess that had benefits as far as freedom of movement, but I suspect it had drawbacks too.
Right. Well, the freedom of movement became actually, as we realized, somewhat of a curse. On the very first day of the war, in fact, after sneaking over the border with some other unilateral journalists, we headed towards Basra after being told by some British and American troops that there were American or British forces ahead of us, closer to Basra. And in fact, their information was wrong. They didn't know that at the time. And we were steaming straight towards Iraqi front lines. And we very fortunately happened to see one of these Iraqi tanks on the side of the road before it was able to get a shot off at us, and we immediately turned around and headed back. So being able to move around freely was a nice idea, but in fact, as we learned, it could also get you killed.
One of the things you write after that first night is, I told myself I would stay with this war for now, see what happened, and pull out if that became the wise thing to do. Oddly, going deeper into the war was the easy way. Deciding that the risks were too high and living with the second-guessing and the feelings of cowardice that might afflict me if I retreated and my colleagues continued on, that would have required real courage.
Well, yeah, I guess I'd like to say maybe that says it all. I mean, that does kind of describe the feeling that I had at the time, because it is, in some ways, at least for me, easier to go forward following colleagues of mine who were also very experienced, more experienced than myself, and kind of leave my fate in their hands to a certain extent, rather than take control of my own fate and say, okay, I'm not doing this because my instincts, my gut tells me this is kind of beyond the levels of risk that any of us should be taking, and turn back. And doing that, taking that decision and having to live with that decision when you know that odds are things will probably turn out okay if you headed forward, that would be hard to live with, because mm-hmm. the odds of going forward, although let's say 9 out of 10 chances you would be fine, well, you know, 1 out of 10 chances that something quite horrible could happen to you, and those, for me at least, aren't good odds.
And throughout the war, we kept hearing these terrible stories, I assume you heard them too, of people who ran into that 1 in 10 chance.
Exactly. I mean, particularly at the beginning of the war, when nobody really knew what the rules were or the full set of dangers confronting them, there were a lot of journalists, particularly unilateral ones, who were captured, who were killed, who were injured, who were ambushed. And so for that reason, at the beginning, particularly in the first few days, we very quickly realized just how unsafe of a war it was to cover on your own, and therefore the necessity actually of kind of de facto embedding yourself with some unit, because that was the only way to have a good chance of surviving and getting to Baghdad.
We're speaking with reporter Peter Moss. His vivid reporting is in the new issue of Outside magazine, also an article earlier in the New York Times magazine about his time in Iraq and his coverage of the Marines as they advanced towards Baghdad. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Later in the program, Dana Priest of The Washington Post will join us to talk about what happened to Private Jessica Lynch. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing some of the many prisms through which one looks at and covers war. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And our guest right now is journalist Peter Maas. He's covered wars in Bosnia, Somalia, Sudan, and Afghanistan. His article on his recent experiences in Iraq is in the July issue of Outside magazine. And Peter, for those who have never experienced, even if you've read about war your entire life, I know that when I was caught up in it, well, you're caught up in it. The size of the thing and the force of the thing is astonishing.
It was particularly so in Iraq because there you had, you know, the land armada of the United States Army and Marines all around you. Driving through the desert, it was just stunning to be part sometimes of a massive convoy that just stretched for miles and miles behind you, but then also to look to your left, to your right, and to see these other convoys just miles long, like streams of ants heading out in all directions, and to realize, you know, this isn't some desert operation, training operation in California. This is Iraq. This is the Middle East. And there is, as far as the eye can see, every sort of military vehicle you could ever imagine that's been taken over here, transported, and is now invading the country. It was a real sense, therefore, of a massive invasion.
You write, you eventually, as you described, eventually hooked up with a Marine unit on the way north. And there were a couple of skirmishes, but nothing serious. As you were approaching Baghdad, you write that, you know, this unit really hadn't seen any combat. And I wanted to ask you, you don't address it in the article, but did you want them to? Did you want to have something to write about?
Well, actually, the unit had seen combat. They just didn't take me and the other unembedded journalists along with them. The combat elements would kind of hive off for the day or for 2 days, go off somewhere, take a little town or a village or whatever, and then come back. But definitely the unembedded group that I was with, we did want to go and see combat because that was where there were things happening, and that was what you're kind of there to report, to describe back home to readers or to viewers or whatever, what war is really like and how this particular war is being fought. So as we approached Baghdad and approached this battle at the bridge, we wanted to be in it, some more so than others, some closer than others.
And as you got to that bridge, this is a story you largely tell in the story in the New York Times Magazine, but as you approach that bridge, you do see war, well, you know, as it was then, maybe not as it is because it is all kinds of different things, but as it was that day with those troops going across that bridge.
It was really a tableau from World War II because they had to take this bridge, but the bridge was damaged, so they couldn't drive any of their vehicles across it. So they had to go across this bridge on foot and then establish a foothold on the other side, the Baghdad side of the bridge, without the protection of armored vehicles. And so, you know, what I saw were, you know, soldiers humping across this bridge, humped over, carrying their M16s, their heavy machine guns, coils of ammunition belts wrapped around them, mortars going over their heads, artillery shells, them firing, and smoke all over the place, the pop of gunfire and howitzers. And it was not a precision war. It was not a tidy war. It was not a clean battle in any sense. It really was war as it had always been fought, very up close and with just men in their boots on the ground.
A number of vehicles came down the road towards the Marines, and as they approached, some warning shots were fired, some were ignored. Then they opened up on these vehicles when they didn't stop. It later turned out most of those people in most of those vehicles were civilians.
These Marines, but I think all Marines and Army soldiers as well, were quite sensitive to the threat posed by suicide bombers, which had taken place. A sister battalion of this battalion I was with had lost a tank to a suicide bomber just the day before. And basically, they had decided that they weren't going to let any vehicle, particularly when they were involved in combat operations, get close enough to them to possibly explode itself and kill Americans. And so as a result of that, if vehicles did not stop from a distance of a few hundred yards, they indeed were stopped by gunfire. And unfortunately, civilians driving vehicles into a combat zone don't necessarily know they're driving into a combat zone. And the soldiers don't know that these vehicles are being driven by true civilians. And as a result, you had a lot of civilians who were killed that day by soldiers who did not want to kill civilians but ended up doing so.
One of them said to you, well, that's war.
And that is war, you know. War, of course, is very many different things these days in terms of surgical bombing and precision strikes and all that. But it also is killing at close range, not knowing if you're killing the person that you think you're killing. And that's the way it's always been. And I don't think, you know, in terms of when you have to actually take ground, that technology is going to be able to, and it certainly didn't in this case, eliminate the fog that has always existed. And you know, as I saw in that particular battle, still exists. And that's how innocent people get killed.
Let's take a phone call. Virgil's on the line with us from San Francisco.
Yes, I read an article recently. I think the journalist's name is Rhodey. Anyway, it's with the New York Times, and he reported one of these skirmishes within the last couple of days. And the enemy, the non-U.S. forces, the people that U.S. were shooting at, were described as, you know, terrorists or Baathists or something along those lines. And I'm curious how, if at all, journalists are able to determine who the enemy is, whether it's a Baathist or a terrorist, or whether it's simply Joe Sixpack Iraqi, who's fed up with the fact that we've occupied their country and decided to take action.
Well, I'm not sure that Peter Moss can answer for the situation now, but you can answer for the situation as you saw it.
Well, I left Iraq just 3 weeks ago, so I guess, you know, my information is still somewhat recent. The problem for not just journalists, but particularly soldiers, is really that they can't tell who's about this, or who's a fedayeen, or who's just a civilian. Because the main problem, and this is why this war was such a hell for many of the soldiers who fought in it, is that the Iraqi combatants, by and large, were not wearing military uniforms, and by and large, were not traveling in military vehicles. They were traveling in civilian vehicles. They were wearing civilian clothes. And so then it becomes very difficult to know, you know, if you see gunfire coming from a building and you see in one window somebody dressed in civilian clothes, whether that person is the man who just fired the shot at you and happened to drop his weapon and was trying to get away, or whether it's just an ordinary civilian caught in the crossfire trying to get away.
Mm. And obviously the troops don't know that stuff either.
Right, exactly, and that's the hell that exists for them.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, the unit made it across that bridge and drove into Baghdad, where it played a central part in one of the most dramatic and certainly most photographs and replayed moments of the entire war.
Yes, this is one of the, you know, to me, most amazing parts of the whole journey that I went through. I was with this particular battalion for a little more than 2 weeks, every day living with them. And then these are the guys who rolled into the center of Baghdad, and I was right behind the colonel of the battalion, Colonel Brian McCoy, as they pulled up to the Palestine Hotel and then proceeded to take down the statue of Saddam Hussein that was, you know, broadcast all across the world live. And that was done by these very same guys who just the day previous had been involved in this very pitched battle that they still had a lot of questions about themselves. It was not as joyous of a moment for them as it was, I think, for many of the people who were watching this on television.
The square was not crowded, many people noticed.
Right, it was not crowded. The square itself was, maybe there were people covering about half of the terrain, but then most importantly, and perhaps you didn't see this on TV, but most of the streets, and I mean basically all the streets leading to the square, because there were many different streets leading to it, were basically empty. The people who were in the square, half of them probably were foreign journalists, and then half were people who, Iraqis who either had been staying at either of these hotels, which were safer places to stay in general than other neighborhoods. So if you had the money to stay there, then perhaps you did. Or people who just happened to live nearby. But at that time, people were staying home because it was unsafe, because they really didn't know what was going on, if the Americans who were there really were in control of the city, and if the Americans were indeed in control of the city, whether they would remain so for a long time afterwards. So the best thing that people thought to do was to just keep their heads down. And as a result, indeed, the square was maybe a few hundred Iraqis there and then a few hundred journalists.
I have to ask you, after Desert Storm, effectively, once the line was crossed and people moved into Kuwait from Saudi Arabia, the system that operated then for journalists, the pool system, it then evaporated, and it was all, everybody was a unilateral and catch as catch can. Did much of the same happen when reporters, did the embed system break down once you got to Baghdad?
Well, it didn't break down so much as in many ways disintegrate, because a lot of the journalists who had been embedded, you know, had a very tough time traveling during this war, and so they decided to go home fairly soon after their units stopped fighting. And so the embeds themselves kind of wandered off, but there still was an effect of the embedded process, you know, which I had felt myself. I mean, I was allowed very good access to the military, even though I wasn't embedded. But then also after the war, I stayed in Baghdad for nearly 2 months, and I had really good access to military units. Now, you know, your reporter was just on the air and complaining about military access, and it is kind of becoming now much more difficult, particularly to the civilians. But it's quite interesting, in fact, that the military embedded journalists allowed them to have extraordinary access to the war, and now in the post-war aftermath, in fact, they're not being terribly helpful. I mean, they could, if they wanted, embed journalists in these operations. My God, journalists were embedded in all kinds of operations during the war, but obviously the military has chosen not to do that now.
I do have to ask you about, the sidebar of your story, and that is the story of the anonymous blogger of Baghdad, who was known as Salam Pax. His website was getting thousands of hits every day as he told the story of the build-up to the war and the beginnings of the bombing. And you discovered belatedly that you had a connection to the Baghdad blogger. Tell us about it.
I had quite a connection to him, as I discovered only after I got back to New York, when I read the blog of this mysterious Baghdad blogger, who nobody really knew whether he was true or not, but certainly he was a popular fellow. And I read his blog, and as I was reading his blog, what he was writing about was quite familiar, because I realized these were things I had done with my interpreter. And lo and behold, actually, I realized with great amusement, this famous Baghdad blogger was my interpreter.
He was your interpreter.
He was my interpreter. He did not tell me while he was blogging in Baghdad that he was doing this. Ironically, some friends of mine who are bloggers, while I was in Baghdad, had emailed me, said, why don't you look into this Salam Pax thing? It's quite interesting. And I thought, oh, no, you know, I could maybe I asked my interpreter to look into it. But I decided not to because I was too busy with real world stuff. And then when I get back, I learned just how big Salam Pax was. And I learned that he was mine. He was my interpreter.
Well, as we all learned, that wonderful new expression we learned in this war, through the soda straw. We're all looking at the war through soda straws, but maybe Salam Pax's soda straw was a little wider than most people's.
Well, he was, he's an Iraqi, a 20-something-year-old Iraqi architect who's very smart and who moved around Baghdad a lot. He didn't have the restrictions while the war was going on that foreign correspondents had. He also didn't have to write in the kind of, you know, dispassionate, impersonal voice that journalists tend to write in. And as a result, what he wrote in the first person, extremely well, extremely lively, extremely informative, was, I think, probably more interesting and more revealing than most of what foreign correspondents who had to be restricted to the Palestine Hotel largely were able themselves to discover and write about.
Have you been able to reach him since you got home and find out how he's doing?
Oh, yeah. Well, we've exchanged emails since then. His father has a Thuraya sat phone. It's hard to get through on. But we've exchanged email. When my story came out, he emailed me back to say, well, I'm glad you're not angry at me, because I was afraid that you might be when you found out. And as a result of the story that I wrote, actually a lot of other journalists and a publisher and an agent, TV, all wanted to get in touch with him. So I've been forwarding him these requests. And he's a bit concerned that I'm going to get fed up with this, because he said the last person who tried to help him navigate through the shoals of the American media got fed up with it and mad at him and hasn't been around since.
Perhaps you should introduce him to the idea of the 15% policy, the slice.
I could do quite well with that, probably.
Well, Peter Maas, your articles are also doing quite well. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Peter Maas is a journalist. He's the author of the article, The Race to Baghdad, which is published in the July 2003 issue of Outside Magazine. Here are some of today's headlines from NPR News. The U.S. Civil Administration in Iraq plans to establish a court to try people accused of attacking Allied troops. It's the latest move to establish a rule of law in that country. Another American soldier was killed in a sniper attack in Baghdad today. In Washington, Democrats want the CIA to release documents about Iraq's weapons programs. Michigan Senator Carl Levin says the intelligence agency has information that would prove the Bush administration withheld key facts in its push to war. And you can hear those stories later today on All Things Considered. At the moment, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.